So welcome everyone to another wonderful webcast exploring a great topic today. The title for today's topic is Psychedelic Emergencies. Is the new psychedelic revolution really an evolution? Today we're blessed to have two great speakers, Mariana Copeland, who I'm actually doing a mentorship with and who I have deep respect for. She's been a therapist for many years and a longtime practitioner in the yoga and Dharma community, author of many books, along with her partner in crime here, Roger Walsh, who is just an extraordinary being, incredibly brilliant individual. And they're going to speak for about 30 or 40 minutes on the topic, and then they're going to open it up for questions. So let me just go over.
And you were Craig Holiday. You didn't mention that.
Oh, yeah. I'm Craig Holiday, one of the co-founders, along with Rick Archer and a number of others from the Association for Spiritual Integrity. And so this is really a communal effort, and we love it when we have great speakers, and we're just really honored today. So thanks, everyone, for showing up. Thank you, everyone, for offering a donation and support for this program and keeping funding the ASI and supporting this type of programming because it's really a community effort. Excuse me if I'm a little bit frazzled because I am the MC and also the button pusher today in charge of the technology. Our normal support person is actually doing an ayahuasca journey right now. And so this is really hot topic. It's something I, as a spiritual teacher and therapist, speak about every day. And so people are really excited to speak about this. So
thanks. Craig is introducing us, but I'm also a board member in the Association of Spiritual Integrity. And on behalf of ASI, I just want to appreciate all of you for showing up. ASI, as you may or may not know, it's just a collective labor of love. It's a bunch of busy people who want to band together and move this forward. And it felt important to me to invite Roger Walsh to converse with me today. He's a dear and old and beloved brother and friend whose work I have immense respect for and love to dig deep into any topic with. Today, what's a little bit different for both Roger and I is that we're speaking on a subject that's not something we either of us usually speak on, though I do want to point out that Roger said, you know, this is not really my subject, and then it arrived in my mail that he had already edited a book on the subject many years ago. To know Roger is to appreciate his humility. It's called Eminent Elders Explore the Continuing Impact of Psychedelics. So this was at a time when they did a conference many years ago, and he wanted to capture the voices of a lot of the elders on the subject. A lot has changed since this book has come out, so we'll look at that. But why I have been speaking about this subject specifically, I do want to acknowledge the immense potential value of the new psychedelic wave that has come in. I personally benefit from it. I've also personally experienced the psychedelic emergency, which I'm happy to talk about if it comes up. But why I wanted to focus, so I want to acknowledge that there's great benefit, and I don't think we're going to focus our conversation on that, because what I'm finding in this big new psychedelic renaissance wave is that the people who are interested in it are very actively promoting the research and, you know, deeply stating the benefits and almost exclusively. And the people who are against it take the polarity of the opposite. And I feel I'm very much both for and against the current psychedelic renaissance. And the reason that I'm against it is because, as a clinician focusing on these topics for so many years, I have been the confidential recipient of massive amounts of psychosis, ethical breaches, sexual breaches, psychotic breaks, and the kinds of things that a lot of people don't talk about. And I found that when I was willing to come forth about my own psychedelic emergency, right, which is, there's reasons people don't talk about it. It's often shrouded in shame. People don't want to come forth and say, you know, I went on this mushroom journey and for 3 years my life was derailed and I fell into a psychotic episode, right? It's a hard thing to come forth and share something like that. That's not my personal story, but something like that, right? So I feel like by addressing discernment in this area, it's a way to balance and fill in a hole in this particular conversation so that we don't fall into the black and white areas of it. And also that we know to be more careful. And I want to say that when I consider psychedelic emergencies, what I've become particularly aware of in the last months is the psychedelic emergencies that result in death. So when that came on board, just like when I've done work with all the spiritual scandals and somebody died in relationship to, indirect relationship to the teacher's spiritual bypassing, you know, when death comes into the picture, it takes a whole other level of seriousness. And that's why I wanted to come forth and address the discernment on the topic. And no one better to do it with than my friend Roger. So Roger, I'd love for you to weigh in a little bit to introduce yourself and your connection to this topic. And then I'll introduce a series of different points for us to dialogue on.
Yeah, thanks very much, Mariana. My day job is as a professor of psychiatry at the University of California, so I have a clinical background and have been drawn into this topic because of an interest in consciousness studies, contemplative practices, the whole array of spiritual issues. So although psychedelics have never been my primary focus, I keep finding myself being drawn back into this topic because these curious chemicals are so powerful and so profound and have such extraordinary potentials and potential issues. There's a saying in medicine that anything which is powerful enough to do some good is powerful enough to do some harm, and psychedelics are no exception. It's really clear that these are very powerful substances which have been used historically and across cultures for thousands of years, and we have anthropological data taking them back to 9,000 BC. And an anthropologist, Bougenon, found that 90% of cultures had institutionalized old estates, primarily with psychedelics, and all of them in a spiritual context, which is a very important thing, I think, for this organization and for all of us to be aware of, because now these chemicals have entered our culture, which has been completely unprepared, and have both expanded our ideas of what humans are capable of, the range of states of consciousness, the potentials, the possibilities, the array of experiences, both highs and lows, and simultaneously have caused a wave of psychological problems. So clearly these are substances we need to be aware of as spiritually interested people, as therapists, as anyone with concerned about spiritual, contemplative consciousness issues. And so I'm delighted to be included in this. Thanks very much, Marianne.
Sure. So I wanted to start by bringing to you, Roger, I mostly will dialogue as you asked me to do, but this wonderful book that I've been looking over, can you do a quick summary of what the most salient points that you did collect from all of these elders? I mean, it's the, you know, Albert Hoffman and James Vadiman and Michael Harner, Ram Dass, Houston Smith. Can you give us a little bit of an overview of the salient points of the wisdom that you did collect from them?
Sure. And maybe a little personal background. My late wife, Frances Fawn, was a subject in one of the early LSD studies and had a very profound and life-changing experience with it. It really gave her a first mystical experience. It redirected her life to the study of contemplative practices, got her into a psychology graduate program. And over time, I met a number of people who'd also been subjects in those studies, and each and every one of them said their lives had been profoundly changed and benefited by that experimental study. And so then I got to wonder, well, if you think about it, people like Ram Dass and Stan Grof and others who were the original guides and researchers have seen a wider array of human experiences than anyone else in human history. You know, a Zen teacher might see maybe 30 deep, really deep satoris. A psychotherapist sees maybe a few dozen major breakthroughs, maybe a few hundred psychoses. But these people who had guided literally hundreds of psychedelic sessions had seen a wider array of profound and problematic experiences than anyone else on the planet. So I really felt that was an irreplaceable reservoir of wisdom, which we really needed to draw on and capture while most of these people were still alive. So we brought them together. And there were several themes that emerged. One was an appreciation for the extraordinary impact and power of these substances. Second, an appreciation of the importance of using them wisely and well. Third, a general principle, and let me step back and say there was one study I did in which I was able to find five people who were spiritual teachers who had had deep awakenings through their practice, but also had deep awakenings through psychedelics. And so these five people, and in general the early researchers, workers in this field, the general principle was, what they said was, these can be very valuable substances, but they need to be used within a spiritual context. And that fits with the anthropological data that in every culture where these substances are used systematically, it's within a spiritual context. So that was a big takeaway. Another thing they pointed to was about the nature of the mind. They consistently pointed to the fact that the mind has an innate tendency towards healing, self-actualization, and self-transcendence under the right circumstances. And that is very important, because that led to the implication that what are the right circumstances for the use of these chemicals? And there were several, but they boiled down most importantly to the old adage of set and setting. That is, that the environment within which they're taken, the supportive social network in which they're used, and particularly the intention that is set, absolutely crucial for determining the kind of experience that emerges and the skill with which it can be worked. Another general principle was that there can be very difficult experiences that emerge, and whether those difficult experiences turn into significant problems, sometimes enduring, or opportunities for psychological, spiritual work and transformation really depends on the skill with which they're approached. And the skill with which they're approached means the skill of a guide, having a guide, the context, the setting in which they're used, and the intention with which they're used. But the general principle was that emerged from their research was that under ideal settings, these can be very safe chemicals, and that difficulties which arise can usually be worked with. And as we well know, and as Mariana, as you just pointed to, there can be real problems when those conditions aren't met. And that idea that psychedelic experiences, no matter how powerful and potentially painful, can usually be worked with under appropriate setting and situations, echoes the idea in Buddhist practice of the so-called lion's roar, that all states of consciousness, all states of mind are potentially workable if one has a practice and a guide and the appropriate intention. So those are some of the things that emerged. I could point to others, but I think that gives us something to work with.
So interesting, as I hear that, I want to start talking about psychedelic emergencies and get into that a little bit. the people who you mentioned have a lot more experience than I do. And certainly, as like you, it's been like a small part of my journey. It's been a large part of my journey to hear the stories and to help people out and to be the recipient through all of my books of the endless crashes and ethical breaches. But I think that there's actually, not only are a lot of these substances taken without ideal set and settings, and certainly without qualified practitioners. But even so, I think that there's many good people with good intentions in a positive setting that still run into psychedelic emergencies. So I want to back up here and define things a little bit. So, and please, if anyone, if we're, Roger or I are using terms that are psychobabble and you're not familiar with, just put it in the chat box and we're happy to clarify. But the term spiritual emergency, which was created by Stan and Christina Groff, so also pioneers in this area, essentially refers to when spiritual awakenings either coincide with the arising of psychopathology or trauma, or different awakenings hit and connect with unworked psychological material and in some way or another overwhelm us to the point of dysfunction. They made a distinction between spiritual emergence, whereas when our spiritual process emerges, it may be destabilizing, but in a positive and workable way, and emergencies where we have dysfunctionality in our life, work, relationships. And I don't think it's actually a term out there, but because I'm running this mentorship program, I gave an additional month to psychedelic emergencies, because as this huge wave of the legalization of all of these different substances and the studies that come out are emerging, every time I hear those wonderful speakers on this talk about it, my gut registers the response that in proportion to the amount of legalization and usage, we're probably going to have a similar proportion of increase in these spiritual and psychedelic emergencies that result from it. And if we don't start talking about it and preparing for it, then if we do start talking about it and preparing for it, I think we can ideally obviate some unnecessary suffering to come. So a few categories that I just noted where the psychedelic emergencies occur in, one area is among ethical breaches, right, between the shaman or shamanic facilitator, group facilitator, and the participants in circles. The mass amount of ethical sexual breaches that often happen between indigenous shamans and younger women is really at an epidemic proportion. But there's any number of often sexual, as in the case with spiritual breaches in the sexual category, but there's huge amounts of ethical breaches that happen in these contexts while participants and then often the shaman or the leader itself is also, of course, taking the medicines. That's a common format that they take medicine while they're facilitating. Another point that I hope to get into with Roger and your psychiatric knowledge is that some of these substances by themselves are not dangerous, but mixed with other substances are creating even lethal effects. The evidence about MDMA mixing with alcohol causing death is really mounting, and how natural it would be to for someone to just think, I just had a drink, you know, a beer and took this ecstasy and suddenly be dead. And I know I'm being strong about this, but it's come straight to my doorstep, which is why I wanted to talk about it. So, and even the mixing of these various different substances, we have so little research on how different substances like ayahuasca and mescaline and all of these substances would be mixing with all the very many not only psychopharmaceutical things that people might be taking, but just supplements and very, you know, seemingly benign herbs. And I think that we're hitting a lot of very strong psychedelic emergencies because of the mixing of substances. when psychedelics stimulate premature kundalini awakenings, Craig has a lot of experience with this, flooding of traumatic material that people aren't prepared to deal with, we find psychotic breaks that aren't just derailing people for a period of weeks or months, but often years of their lives. I've heard many, many such accounts. And also when there would be like a psychopathological tendency in the individual, and then the substance is catalyzing that. And furthermore, the last point I want to make and see how this resonates with you, Roger, but because in my focus in psychotherapy, I specialized and studied and taught trauma so much, I find that this, in trauma healing, one of the strongest emergent pieces of knowledge is that our deep, tender traumas tend to be healed with gentleness, and they're healed with Peter Levine, who I studied with, who founded Somatic Experiencing. He talks about titration, so you learn to go in and digest trauma in bite-sized morsels in the context of a resourced or place of well-being inside of ourselves, and you go in between the trauma and the well-being, and that this is a much more effective way to digest and focus trauma. So often with the concept of these heroic doses and the medicines, there's many different kinds of medicines, but the medicines that blast us beyond our conscious control, it's quite antithetical to a lot of my understanding of trauma healing. So I think a lot of spiritual emergencies emerge when people's their trauma inside of themselves is prematurely stimulated. And it may appear heroic and we're going through these powerful ancestral experiences, but when I look at my clinical practice and the accounts of my clients who have done 100 or 200 sessions of this or that, I haven't yet seen their trauma being healed more quickly as a whole because of that. So those are some of the areas that I'm thinking about these days and very concerned about. I'm going to pass it back to you, Roger.
Well, there's so much in what you said. And let me just emphasize as a context one thing you said, but quickly, so I want to make sure it doesn't get lost, and that is that these are very early days, and as yet, we have very little information. So it's not clear, for example, we don't really even have a really good map of spiritual emergencies. Yes, Stan and Christina, on the mixing of drugs, as you pointed out. And we really don't as yet have a lot of data on clinical use of these substances. Clearly, they can be beneficial, and one of the key questions will turn out to be, who are they beneficial for and under what circumstances? The early research, and there's some subsequent research being done at Johns Hopkins now, seems to suggest the people who benefit therapeutically, for example, with addiction or the alleviation of near-death anxiety, what seems to be crucial there is some sort of spiritual experience, some sort of very deep spiritual opening as therapeutic. So let's see, again, so much in what you said. Does traumatic healing need to be titrated? Can there be dramatic releases with deep or intense psychedelic experiences? I suspect as in most things, it will turn out that for some people under some circumstances, yes, it can be, and for others it may be much more problematic. I don't think we have that kind of data yet, but the general principle from a variety of sources I'm just pulling together in my head suggests to me that for some psychological issues, including trauma, I would expect that some people could benefit from intense psychedelic experiences, but others not. So those are some of the principles. There's an awful lot in what you put out, and why don't we go back to you and see where you'd like to take it, Mariana?
Okay. And again, as I said this, but I want to affirm that as I'm speaking to the dangers, I'm somebody who personally benefits from occasional use of psychedelic experiences for myself. I think that when I use gentler substances and use it in the context of my own spiritual practice, it's immensely beneficial. So as I speak to the dangers, I really want to hold that I'm well aware of the benefits. And particularly for me, the research about the benefits with people who have life-threatening illnesses, people who have treatment-resistant depression and may never have had any kind of mystical or greater awareness, some uses of it for addiction. Like there is research on certain conditions that I feel even that the risk would outweigh, the con. So I want to acknowledge that as well. One thing that bothers me about a lot of the research that I read, because I'm on the MAPS newsletter and I follow it, is that when I read this research, there is usually an assumption that having a mystical experience equals some kind of deeper transformation. That because they produce mystical experiences for many people, that is equal to spiritual or personal transformation. And having, again, delved into the topics of my books of premature claims to enlightenment and one of my beloved mentors and great friends, John Wellwood, who died a year ago, and his immense work on integrating psychology and Buddhism and his articulation of spiritual bypassing, which I regularly speak to, which is how we use spiritual paths, practices, processes to bypass or avoid dealing with subtler issues of self-esteem, human development, relationship, parenting, so forth, that piece. And also John's assertion that I really have seen over and over again, that spiritual experience and even spiritual awakening does not necessarily parallel a process of psychological healing and integration. And it often is used to bypass it.
So, and even more than bypass, sometimes it becomes a source of grandiosity and inflation, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. So I just wanted to highlight in the, for the purposes of discernment that I do not assume that because somebody has a big mystical experience that it translates into their daily life, and certainly that it would by itself mean that there's any kind of deep psychological or trauma, relational healing that's happening. And I hope that the researchers start paying attention to that, because I put years and years into books making that point because of what I saw. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to bring this point up, Roger, and speak to spiritual bypassing and the relationship of mystical experiences to other areas of human integration.
Yeah, it's a very important point. And Ram Dass was well aware of this very early on. I remember asking him about this issue and him saying, it's not that these substances, chemicals, do something to you. It's much better to think of how you use them and what you do with them. And making, because I realized the way I was framing it was a somewhat passive, assumption that these chemicals do something to us. And one of the things that is so remarkable about psychedelics is they can magnify or amplify or bring into awareness aspects of the psyche. But so much, and I think this is what you're suggesting, depends on how we relate to them. And in developmental psychology, if we think of Piaget, there's the distinction between assimilation and accommodation. That assimilation, we take novel experiences into and fit it Procrustianly into our previous personality and assumptive framework. But accommodation is when the new experiences, we relate to the new experiences in a more fluid, open manner, and thereby are transformed by them. And you know, either can happen, and if they're simply assimilated into our previous personality structure, and then it's quite possible they'll inflate some of the pathological aspects. Mm-hmm. And again, comes back to having a, you know, if one has a practice. First off, let's say there are no guarantees. I think that's one of your implications for what you're saying. There aren't any guarantees with these substances. And yet there are some precautions. There are some things which make it more likely that they'll be beneficial than otherwise. And of course, some of those are principles that have been enunciated over centuries in different cultures.
Yeah.
But you're pointing to, Mariana, to a wave of new, as these substances become increasingly popular and we're going through this resurgence, you're pointing to the fact that you're seeing a wave of really severe problems. Of course, let's acknowledge that you see a very selected group, but it's a very important selected group, because these are the kinds of problems that are going to not only cause an enormous amount of suffering for some individuals, but I suspect it's quite likely they'll take us back to a previous phase of criminalization, and we may end up with the same reaction against them as emerged from the 60s.
Yeah. And that's right, Roger. It's a very specific, selected group. I've often shared, I felt like my function in life that I'm avidly trying to outgrow is that I've been like a spiritual garbage dump, or a good day is a compost heap, and for all the devastation that comes through the pipeline. And it's mostly confidential. So it is select. But I'm really, I said this earlier, but I'm struck by the secrecy and the shame that surrounds that specific group that I'm talking about, because it's very hard for people to bring that information forth. Mm. And by bringing what is in the dark into the light of our shared awareness and starting to address it, that could be what helps us to not have, you know, another wave of shutdown around this. So I fear that if it's not brought forth and addressed and acknowledged, especially by the people who are promoting all of the research, then it's like it's a blind spot, or at least a hole in the big wave of popularization.
Yeah. And so I really appreciate the stance you're holding, which is one of openness to both the positive and the problems, and a balanced one. And unfortunately, as you're saying, as with so many hot topics, people tend to cluster in the extremes of either extremely pro or extremely con. I would find it very helpful, and I suspect everyone else might too, if you would say a little bit more about the varieties of problems and pathologies that you're seeing. You listed primarily ethical breaches of one kind or another. You mentioned very briefly that you've even heard of some deaths, and I think I assume also maybe suicides. Could you say a little more about some of the other psychopathologies, spiritual pathologies, interpersonal pathologies that you see as you consult with people?
And you know, on the subject of death, I knew somebody who died of a potentially psychedelic related emergency. And in my conversations about this, that's when suddenly, you know, when you come forth and start talking about something, then people will come to meet it if you go first. And the things that came out of the closet around any number of deaths were really, really surprising to me. Some were overdoses. We had a recent one. I live here in Northern California, and it was a teenage suicide related to from a teenager who was taking mushrooms. And And on that point, one of my other concerns is as these substances become progressively legalized, it brings the youth more access to them. So to the far extreme of somebody doing this in a spiritual context, a set and setting, I don't know the full details, but it was a young man jumped out of a window just a few weeks ago, right near where I live, with the influence of mushrooms. Another psychotherapist in our area, she hung herself while taking ayahuasca. So we're not talking about people who are unaware or people who don't have a spiritual or psychological background. We're talking about good, sane practice people. I want to make that point too. It's not, I feel as I'm learning more and more that it's, we always want to think, well, we would be exempt from X, and that's why I want to bring forth the point that these things happen, not to them, but to us. I was just in Peru for the first time, and because I'm always thinking about these things, people were sharing a lot of the different crises that are happening with shamans there. And of course, there's the obvious of sexual abuse, and the frequency of it, I don't want to underscore because it's gigantic. But some of the other issues that people were describing to me and made a lot of sense to me was that a lot of these substances, they're bringing forth personal, ancestral, collective trauma. And just like this issue that we've hit with the Eastern gurus coming to the West, and they can teach the spiritual principles, but they're unprepared to handle the Western psyche. A male Indian guru is not going to, often misses the nuance of what the Western female psyche needs and for its healing and integration. That's been clear to me for a long time, but it makes sense in the same way. Why would we expect a South American shaman who lives in the jungle to be prepared to handle and address and hold space for the Western, the Western wounds and psychopathologies and traumas that are completely foreign to their culture? It would be unrealistic to expect for them to have that kind of knowledge. And in so many of these cases, a lot of what happens as well is that people in these shamanic settings, that people, you come and you go. So, you come and you do one or many, many journeys with a person, and then you don't see them again. You may not even have access to them. So when there's fallout, there's another topic I want to go to next, perhaps, is about integration, but there's no follow-up for it. Another thing that people were talking to me about who are actually involved in leading medicine work in Peru was that, this one surprised me a little bit, but one modality that happens in, I think especially in ayahuasca, is the use of these powerful songs and singing things into the participants. And they found that a number of shamans, like the shamans' own, whatever the version of psychopathology would be, mixing with their own wisdom, like in so many teachers, their brilliance and their blind spot. And they were singing into their participants great distortions. They were, because in an ayahuasca journey, big material might come up, they were diagnosing prematurely, oh, this means you were sexually abused. And this means, you had probably done something to someone else in another lifetime. And these, again, right, these are the leaders in great positions of power. So their own blind spots as a leader, many of them, which would be no fault to themselves, that were having a cultural, a cultural encounter here, were causing great harm. So that's a few of them. And of course, this piece that we already talked a little bit about, the mixing of substances. And people aren't doing just a journey, right? It's very common now that people are mixing mescaline with ayahuasca. They go to journeys where there's actually stated concoctions. And maybe it did work for the first 50 tries that the person, the facilitator brought forth, but Craig or me is likely to get the 51st one, that it didn't work for. And if you have 100, and two, there's already two. And if you have 500, we have, five 5 spiritual emergencies, and that's a lot. So back to you, Roger. And in a few minutes, we'll open it up to the others.
Yeah, well, I'm struck by an issue which we see not only with psychedelics, but in spiritual communities so frequently, a kind of bizarre idealization of teachers. And the idea that we would expect shamans to be free of pathology or to be completely ethical, to me, seems rather naive. Just because someone uses psychedelics doesn't mean they've cleaned up their game completely, nor they're completely mature, nor they're free of pathology. One of the implications you pointed to was that, you know, consciousness is catchy. And that you want to be, it's really important if you're using psychedelics to be careful whose mind you want to share, because there is a sharing of minds, and that does mean a kind of karmic contamination, to use that framework. So a couple of principles from what you said. One, the trap of idealizing teachers. Second, the incredible sensitivity and picking up of both positive and negative transmission from anyone we're with under these substances. Third, the importance of integration you pointed to, and you said you'd like to say more about that, and I hope you will. So maybe I'll just stop there.
Let's talk about integration, and that is a new buzzword in the psychedelic research circles. It is emerging as a topic. My experience as a clinician and a practitioner is that transformation usually happens. Sometimes a big awareness will be sufficient to create a transformation in my life, but usually it's an awareness or an insight accompanied by an action, accompanied by making practice actions, even symbolic actions, into our outer life that ends up resulting in the transformation that is sustainable. So, for example, in Peru, I heard one of the stories that somebody was sharing. A woman had come and done several ayahuasca sessions. She had a massive spiritual psychotic crisis, and her what the shaman suggested and many do is come back and work it through. And so come back and do more substance to work it through. And that's really actually a very common protocol that's shared by facilitators, which is completely counterindicative to everything that I know. But the process of integration, so rather than going for more and more and more, like what do we do? What do we do after the session? And, you know, that question belongs to the facilitators. What are you creating? But because they're not only not creating those environments, but most of them aren't prepared. They don't have the skill set to do the integration process. So even considering setting up in advance a plan, you know, to work with an open-minded psychotherapist to implement, right, to make practical the insights, to digest, to talk through, seems like a really critical state. I mean, a really critical process. And Roger is a good friend of a popular speaker on the subject, Jamie Wheel, Wheeler. He's an amazing speaker. I've been really excited by what he's saying. But he's really leaning on the less is more edge, where he's a proponent of the usage. But what happens if we partake of a substance and then really spend, you know, dedicated time and attention to integration and allow space between an experience and the next experience? What if instead of, when I hear about, you know, you go to Peru and you do 7 ayahuasca ceremonies in 10 days, and I have heard the breakthroughs, I've definitely heard them, but in my heart and with my background in trauma, I think, what if you go and do one session and have 7 months of integration, you know, just a theoretical number, you know, and then go in for another installment when when that material is digested. So yeah, I want to just bring the question of integration to you. And Roger, what I know very well about you and your life is that you are first and foremost a practitioner, and that you have always put in and prioritized the time to your own personal practice. So I believe you must know many things about this.
Thank you. I wish I knew more. But there's a lot in what you said, so let me play with that. And first off, just thanks for emphasizing the importance of integration, because there certainly can be a trap, and I've fallen into this myself, of not giving adequate time and situations to fully absorb the gifts that can come from these substances. So I think there are two things that would be valuable to look at here. How does integration occur, and how can we facilitate it? And let's acknowledge first off that we don't have, at least I haven't been able to find much, that really is sophisticated on how integration occurs. There's some suggestions in the Buddhist meditation literature, because of course the Buddhists with their insight practices are the ones who watch the microprocessing of mind and have drawn out some principles from there. And the best I've seen has come from the Bon tradition, but they point to the idea that that it's not enough to have an experience. The experience must be reflected on. The implications must be drawn out of it. The associated ideas and context ideas must be considered. It must be viewed in the light of one's ideals and highest principles, and one needs to find ways to look for the barriers, the blocks, the quotes classic word defilements that stand in the way of actualizing the implications of these insights. And then one looks for ways to express them for the benefit of everyone. So there's a rich process of integration, which the Bon people seem to have offered the most sophisticated map I've found of. As to the things that can foster integration, that seems a really important thing for us to consider. And given that, again, to emphasize one of the principles you've been drawing out, that so much depends on how these substances are used and ways in which they're approached. So principles that I'm aware of for optimizing integration include, first off, just simply time, uninterrupted time to be with and reflect on the implications of an experience. Second, having some sort of interpersonal support, wise friends and mentors and guides to be able to talk with about this. Sometimes formal psychotherapy can be very valuable. A teacher can be valuable. And as you pointed out, often in these shamanic tribal situations, people kind of fly in for a tourist ayahuasca session and there isn't adequate follow-up. It's very helpful to have practices and techniques. Some of the contemplative practices, for example, Stan Grof with the holotropic breathwork session, and formerly in psychedelic, when he was in previous years when psychedelic research was legal, would use things like mandala drawing, body work. And a wide variety of contemplative practices. These are the things that come to my mind as I think of the ways in which integration can be facilitated and the richer and the problems and challenges of these substances can be mitigated and the benefits can be potentially mined.
I feel that a great question is always worth more than any kind of premature answers. So when you say, Roger, that there's not so much that we know about integration, like that makes my heart sing by itself, not because I don't wish that we knew more. And of course, you went on in great detail to share what you know, many approaches that are in your awareness of what creates integration. But I really appreciate when, you know, an elder and a pioneer in the field and somebody in your position can and will say to us, we don't know that much about integration, because like in the same fervor of legalizing substances, now it's been pointed out that we need integration. So you'll go to the same research and say, there'll always be a paragraph saying, you know, and it's very important to integrate afterwards, make sure you set up a circumstance for integration. And then it's like the integration base is being covered. But when we point out, like, what is that question? Like, what does it mean to integrate? Yeah. What are the practical processes and possibilities? Like, let's get detailed, not about the way that it is, but about that we don't really understand that yet and that we need to live into that. I am aware it's almost time to turn our attention to everyone else, but I also do want to share, I just glanced down at my notes, and one of my favorite pieces that Roger's ever, well, not ever written, but that I've read and shared with all my grad students when I used to teach grad school at CIS, was his article called Medicate or Meditate. And he addressed the complementary value of medication, meditation, and psychotherapy. So maybe if you could just weigh in based on the insight of that article, which I highly recommend everybody read. I've had to, because I've worked in the spiritual field for so long, I've had to pound down the doors of many, many spiritual people's resistance and adversity to the value of psychopharmaceuticals and in their rightful function. So whereas maybe collectively as a culture we err on the other side of taking them too easily, I found that people who are spiritually oriented have shame, resistance, reluctance to use the benefit of psychopharmaceuticals. So I had all of my graduate students read and be challenged by your article over the years, Roger. So let's see how it pertains to this subject, and then we can open it up.
Yeah, okay. Let me just give a very, very brief synopsis, and some of the implications will be apparent. You pointed to what I call a spiritual superego, and that takes a variety of forms, and one of them is that I, as a spiritual practitioner, should not need medications such as antidepressants or anxiolytics or whatever. That spiritual practice should do it all. And the analog of that, of course, is that if I take enough psychedelics, then I'll be able to work through whatever I'm dealing with. As you pointed out, sometimes I think it can be valuable to have an additional session under the right circumstances to work through issues which were left unresolved in a previous session. And sometimes it's much better to back off and go to more gentle approaches, psychotherapy, meditation, contemplation, etc. But it's clear that we are in a unique situation in human history, simply in the extraordinary panoply of practices and therapies that are now available to us. And one of the issues of our time is how do we use these most skillfully, both individually, as in psychedelics, and this whole conversation is about what are the skillful uses of psychedelics and what are the problems. And let's again acknowledge we're still very early days. We know so little about spiritual emergencies, know so little about the full array of benefits and problems that can emerge from psychedelics. And but the key issue from that article, I think, was we're called to look at how to best use and complement and integrate the wide variety of approaches we have now, and not to assume that one approach should do it all. And that all of us are called on to use our own wisdom, hopefully in the company of wise people, to select the most appropriate practices and in some cases medications to help us through the traumas and pains and pathologies that all of us bear, and to actualize and grow.
So I want to open it up to you all. I'd like to start with you, Jerry. Jerry has been proactively, passionately sharing some Well, today he shared with Roger and I a protocol that he has created for working with overwhelm and to mediate strong psychedelic experience. So maybe, Jerry, if you could just be brief and share a sentence about your background that led you to it and an overview of the protocol, and then share it in the chat box. I think that would be useful for people.
I am profoundly grateful to Mariana, you and Roger for this discussion. There, I'm certain, are literally millions and millions of people who eventually will benefit from this very meeting. And I have absolute confidence that that is the case. And so, you know, let me just again express my heartfelt gratitude that you're bringing this out. Well, it's hard to state my background in a sentence or two. I have a clinical background. I'm a certified nutritional consultant. I was office manager in a doctor's office in the 1990s. He was a nutritionally oriented osteopathic physician, and we did a lot of work concerning you know, different nutritional modalities that could play into many of the different kinds of things that people were having to face. I'm a 50-year meditator. When I was a teenager, I was there were a couple of years where I was quite actively using various of the psychedelic drugs that were available at the time. I had some, you know, you could say transformative awakening experiences, but as Mariana described, they didn't lead to my life being transformed. They were transformational in the sense that they opened up the possibility for me that there might be something like unity consciousness. And that led me on to learn transcendental meditation when I was just before my 19th birthday. And then over the decades since then, I've myself, you know, sort of gone through a sequence of, you know, fairly classical, you know, spiritual awakening stages. Eventually that developed to sort of resonate with that kind of unitive opening that I only first, for the very first time in my life, experienced with the psychedelics when I was a teenager. In the last couple of years, also, you know,
I'm going to have you jump to the protocol because there's so many people who want to hear from us.
Okay. Well, let me give you a one-sentence intro to the protocol. It's not just based on theory. I've worked this out pretty systematically in my own brain chemistry with very, very cautious microdosing experimentation. At far smaller doses than a standard microdose, typically a hundredth of a standard microdose, which I find in my particularly sensitive brain chemistry is actually quite potent and did actually create destabilizing side effects that I had to figure out how to deal with, which, you know, kind of put me in the position of being a laboratory animal for this experimentation. So the protocol itself, I don't have it before me, but there's a lot of psychiatric pharmacology in it that I won't try to detail, but I'll just mention that because Dr. Walsh might be interested for me to document where some of those recommendations came from at some point. Generally speaking, all of these substances, whether it's psychedelic drugs or THC or many, many other things, you know, life experiences, tend to overactivate the excitatory neurotransmitters in the brain, specifically glutamate and the catecholamines, and especially adrenaline. And sometimes there's a toxic oxidative byproduct of adrenaline that kind of persists in the brain and deranges things. And the nutrients and one herbal modality that I'm suggesting here all serve to settle the brain down, and they do it in specific ways. So I've given you guys a PDF of the protocol itself. I'm recommending fairly high doses of niacinamide, which is a form of vitamin B3.
Just quickly, Jerry's been on BatGap, and he also is active on Facebook, and I'm sure people can get in touch with him through either means, and he'll send you a whole copy of this thing that he's referring to.
Yeah. Great. Thanks, Jerry.
From Timothy, I hope you can discuss long-term ramifications of plant medicine use, issues coming up years later after use. I have some very unusual experiences around spiritual energy, but I sometimes wonder if plant medicine work years ago is influencing this, ayahuasca specifically.
Yeah.
Roger?
I think it's a great question, and I don't think we have the answers. I assume that any of these chemicals can set in motion a process, a psychological, spiritual, chemical, et cetera, process, which can produce long-term effects. But I assume also there's a wide individual variation. I assume it depends on the variety of other practices and that people are doing. So I don't think it's going to be, I don't think A, we have any final answers, and B, it's going to be a simple answer. It's probably going to depend on a variety of factors, from individual variation to what other practices people are doing. And of course, the chemicals that are used and the setting with which they are done.
And what I'll add in here, I actually have very limited experience with ayahuasca. I took it one time about 11 or 12 years ago and found that it was really too strong for my nervous system to make use of. I had powerful experiences. I made some use of it because of my spiritual training. But I would say that again, when I hear somebody say to me, because people like to tell me about their spiritual experiences, and they say, you know, I've done over 100 ayahuasca sessions, and they give the amounts of things that they have taken. I never have the assumption that more use is going to be leading to greater benefit. I hold it neutrally, but with concern. And one danger that I've noticed, and again, this is, you know, as Roger's saying, we there's so much more that we don't know than what we do know. But when I've seen some of these psychedelic emergencies that wouldn't fall into like a linear category, it's like emergencies that happen in the context of the field of somebody immersed in a psychedelic journey. One thing that I've noticed that I've barely been able to give language to is that sometimes individuals and groups of people, they start to live in a magical universe, because the experiences bring forth, you know, they access us to probably very true but parallel fields of consciousness. That, and even in Peru in this trip, I would be present to people, like really almost like living in a parallel universe to this one, where because the awareness that we're more than what we might ordinarily see and experience is so powerful and is so life-changing, it almost becomes prioritized. It's like I often think of integration as we have our upper world consciousness or transcendental middle world, this world, and our underworld and our shadow consciousness. And because that upper world consciousness has been so underlived in people's lives, it gets prioritized. And I think that people can make very poor choices when living in those fields. And I think groups of people who do work together over a long period of time, it's very easy to get derailed in that way. And I think it's something to watch out for. And it's probably something that it would be very hard to identify in ourselves, which is why the role of some system of feedback from trusted others, not just others who will tell us what we want to hear, but trusted others or someone who loves us enough to try to point that out, is really important.
Yeah, Marianne, if I can take off on that, I think one topic we haven't talked about today is who shouldn't use these chemicals possibly ever. And at least three categories come to my mind. One are people with any kind of psychotic tendency, history of psychosis. I'm not saying some people can't benefit, but when I hear someone who's had a psychotic break previously talking about using these chemicals or using significant amounts of marijuana, I definitely get worried. I've dealt with a number of these people in hospital, so I think it's a problem. Manic depressive disorder is also an issue. I've known people, including one of my professional colleagues, who a very brilliant, eminent mental health professional, who has ran into significant trouble using these chemicals in that way. And third, young people, as far as I can see, the research is in getting just more and more compelling that, for example, a significant amount of marijuana use in an adolescent brain is just not a good combination. Those are the three categories that come to my mind. Marianne, are any others you think of?
No, but I do want to emphasize the last category of the young people. Again, I live here in Liberal, California, and I have a teenage son. And it's been very interesting to hear because, of course, marijuana is legal here, and I'm very pro-cannabis for the people that it works for, but it's been so interesting to hear many friends who are parents say, you know, until now I was really supportive of the legalization of marijuana, but now seeing that because of its legalization, how accessible it is to our youth has, you know, really challenged my liberal stance on it. And, you know, we live in a place where there's lots, and half my town does yoga, and the parents are savvy, and we have huge problems with especially marijuana and other substances already in the middle schools. So it's one of my greatest areas of concern that I think, you know, the research, I think it extends up to, you know, people in their early 20s. And it's just a really tricky category. I'm for and against. I utterly support all the, you know, hearing, and I love to hear about the benefits of cannabis and CBD research. And then what is that modeling and that availability doing, you know, for our children and our teens who developmentally are not even at an age where they could have the discernment necessary. It's not a part of where they developmentally are in their arc. So I just feel like it's important to emphasize that point. Roger, there's a related question that I think is goes specifically to you. And Josine said, working as a medical doctor in Western medical practice, do you have any advice or recommendations or experience on how to take care of someone coming into a hospital setting with a spiritual emergency triggered by the use of psychedelic substances that is not recognized or addressed as such by colleagues because of the awareness of the spiritual component of the emergency is not available to them? Any suggestions on how to bridge the gap between the Western medical practice and spiritual community so the best care can be provided in these situations?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of general principles. One is to draw on a variety of resources that if people are in a psychiatric hospital as a result of using psychedelics or having a spiritual emergency, then it's pretty significant. You've got to be pretty disturbed to get hospitalized these days simply because of the economics. So first off, to be certainly willing to make use of the medical personnel and the psychiatrist. And second, not to limit the care to that. If the person is having a spiritual emergency of some kind, then to bring in the people who will be sensitive to and honor that perspective, and who that is, of course, will depend on the patient, but it could be anything from a priest to a trusted guide of one kind or another, but ideally someone who will will be open-minded to using the best of all approaches. So that's one thing, drawing on all the possible resources as regards particular kinds of supportive practices. Again, so much depends on the individual, just how disturbed they are, what they're capable of making use of, but being open to the variety of alternative approaches, from exercise to nutrition. Jerry was getting to the importance of nutrition, to really drawing on the best of everything that's available. And that could mean, as we talked about before, for example, artwork or mandala drawing, or and of course psychotherapy. So in general, draw on the widest array of resources appropriate to the person and their condition.
Yeah. I want to add to that we, in my mentorship program, just spent the last month and talking about this subject. And one of the ideas that one of the mentees brought forth, it was an inspiration, but I really resonated with it, would be to have a version of doulas to help mitigate, like a psychedelic doula, to help mitigate in these hospital situations. And an organization like MAPS, or you know, these big organizations that are pioneering this study, I think it's a beautiful idea to consider the training of doulas to really both support the individual and translate to the medical staff. And as you were talking, Roger, I was remembering when I had my own psychedelic emergency about 5 years ago, that one of the psychiatrists that I consulted with and didn't end up staying with, but she was well known in this field, and she was very dismissive and shaming of me. And right, I was in a flat out huge crisis. I was already, you know, incredibly, I was already ashamed, self-recriminating, you know, and devastated by what I had brought upon myself. And then it was in a much more vulnerable state than I usually am. So to have a medical caregiver at that point and be shaming and saying, you know, it was your fault for taking these party drugs, and it was devastating in a way that me in a regular state, you know, I could let roll off what needs to, but in that state, right, it deeply impacted me. So I'm just thinking about how, like, that piece of psychological training, whether it was a doula, or how do we get that to the medical staff who are fueling that, because it was uniquely devastating. And, you know, when we get these ideas about something like having doulas or something that needs to happen, I want to say to the ASI growing community that if something you really resonate with calls to you, that there aren't all of these other people out there who are going to take the initiative and make these things happen. I think Roger and Craig and Rick, we all have this experience. You know, I was always waiting because I felt like, what do I know? I'm a young person. How can I write a book about this? And I was a young person. And you start to really understand how, in this, I like to call it an army of love, like everybody's really needed. And there's not somebody else there's not enough people available for all of the healing work that needs to be done. So whether it's this idea, or, you know, Jerry shares this valuable protocol, like, I want to urge you all, and in ASI in general, we want members to jump in and create and co-create and initiate projects. And I want to take that opportunity to urge you all, if there's something you see that needs to be done. I was saying to my mentees earlier this morning, it always feels like jumping off a cliff when you do something like that. And when we take those risks, when it's something, you know, as ethical and noble and beautiful and for the good. I found, and I imagine you have too, Roger, that the world is often, there's going to be, you get a lot of resonance. You get, your efforts are not lost on the world.
Yeah, nice. Thank you.
Jerry?
So I want to make clear what I want to do with this protocol. I have enough data. By this point, I will contact James Fadiman, whom you mentioned in the beginning. He is now the kind of world authority on microdosing and also on citizen science as it pertains to these matters. And I want to look for people that are interested basically in trying out the protocol. It's all over the counter. It's all extremely benevolent nutritional stuff. And it does rather powerfully nourish the brain chemistries that are needed for the brain to be able to settle itself down. So I'd like to have the opportunity for people to share that protocol, try it out, possibly correspond with me a little bit by email, and we might tinker with it. We have as a community the opportunity here to refine and develop the resources, and I think this could turn into a quite a valuable resource to help to address this whole, you know, very serious area of concern. So that's what I wanted to add.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Chris writes a very valuable question. What are recommended specific resources for furthering this conversation? Resources for integration, later resource, case studies, et cetera. And I'll start here and then go to you, Roger. But you know, interestingly, neither Roger or I do, you know, this is not our primary area of focus. I, as I said, because of a friend's death, I was pummeled into a much deeper level of investigation and these topics and felt that this message needed to be shared. And when I thought who I want to share, you know, who I want to help sharing it with, I thought of Roger. So I think that's a great question. I want to hear what you say, Roger, but I want to point out, I mean, the MAPS, the, what is it, multidisciplinary, whatever it stands for, MAPS, you'll find it all over the web.
Multidisciplinary Association.
But the resources in terms, again, I support this organization, but I feel the bias on favoring the positive and not giving enough weight and attention to the emergencies and the challenges is present there. And I don't know who you are, Chris. I don't even think I see your face, but one of the resources is like you starting to talk about it, and you or someone, you know, any of you to start furthering the conversation. We're here because I wanted to further the conversation at least for a month of my life and prioritize it. And I think we do it by speaking out. And for people who have had psychedelic emergencies, I think coming out of the closet about that is really important, because the biggest support for other people to start speaking out about it is somebody that they respect going first and sharing, and then feel another person feeling not alone. There's other people who are willing to share that. And I think every person who does that adds really important information to the field. Roger.
Yeah, for resources, the two, I'm thinking here that there are a couple of overlapping literatures which are valuable here. One is spiritual emergencies, one is psychedelics. People who I trust and feel do a really balanced job with this, Charles Grobe at the University of California, Los Angeles, who's written a couple of books and edited a couple of books on psychedelics. And he brings a very informed, very balanced cross-cultural perspective to bear. Another person is, of course, the work of Stan Grof, one of the great pioneers in the field, who certainly has been a proponent of the value of these chemicals, but is also aware that they need to be very carefully used, and has did more research than anyone else on the planet on them, and also pioneered, along with his wife, Christina, as you mentioned, Mariana, the whole field of spiritual emergencies. So I think his work in conjunction with Christina's are very good resources there.
And if somebody is inspired to write a book about discernment on the psychedelic journey and collect all of that information, that would be very much appreciated by past, present, and future people. I'm not going to take that one on, which is why I'm suggesting it to others. And you'll have a great full career after you do that. I feel it's really important that I like to suggest to people that they take the initiative and take the leap, because I think we really all do have a voice and something important to share. We're at the top of, well, I guess we've got a few more minutes. Can you give an example of an emergency? What actually happens? What's the experience? Okay, since we're at the end, I'll give a little bang here. So 5 years ago, I use a plant medicine called San Pedro. Usually yearly, it would be a friend of ayahuasca, but much, much milder, and used it yearly for several years. That year I wasn't able to make the meeting, so I asked the facilitator if I could take it on my own. That person wasn't available to do that, so they gave me a synthetic substance called 5-MeO-DALT. And like one of the authors in Roger's book, I think it was Shulgin, he authored that chemical. There's a lot of positive research on it.
Was that 5-methoxy-DMT?
No, it's a different one. It's like lesser known and lesser research, because I've looked at everything I could find in my own integration of the experience. It was 5-MeO-DALT.
Okay.
And what it created in me, I'm going to summarize this quickly, but I'm doing it for, you know, to encourage you all to come forward with these things as well. It actually put me in an immensely positive mystical state of hyper creativity. It resembled my previous Kundalini experiences in life that had been very positive. I'd had two Kundalini periods. So, and after the substance ended, the state remained for about 4 months. And because it resembled my deepest spiritual experience, I trusted it and assumed that it was a spiritual experience. In retrospect, when it crashed, I realized that I was in a manic episode, and I have no history of bipolar, no history of that, so I had no even clue to be looking for that. My set and setting was very positive, and I made very large leaps during that time. I sold my house in favor of a larger thing because I was going to support the vision that I was creating. And almost overnight, after 4 months, well, there was one day, and again, I'm summarizing the story, but I woke up and realized what had happened, that it wasn't a trustworthy Kundalini experience. It was actually some kind of schism in my brain chemistry. And that what I had created, although the vision was very bright and possible, I didn't even want it. And then the subsequent trauma of having made such a big mistake, the impact on my life in the months to come, my child, my career, and everything that I had done was so devastating. And it was really, I feel like, both because I had the psychological knowledge to look for the right kinds of help and to assess it even in my state, and I was in a really fragmented state, and because I had the resources, which I think is really important. It came up in my program, right? A lot of people who are going to be in spiritual emergency states aren't going to have the resources to be able to do what I did, nor the knowledge to find the help or the willingness. And I employed a psychotherapist and had to go through a couple of psychiatrists to find the right help, and you know, drew on all of this knowledge that I already had. And it took about a year and a half to pull out of it and fully recover what I'd lost. And I came out the better of it, but again, I had all of the inner and outer resources to do that. So that is an example of how something, you know, really, difficult could happen to somebody well prepared with all the right context and the spiritual practice, and wanted to, you know, share it as an example of the need to out these experiences so that they're not overshadowed by the overenthusiasm in the field.
Yeah, thank you very much for being willing to share that and lead the way with that. And thank you also, particularly what I really appreciate about what you're bringing to this topic is your open-minded balance. And as I mentioned before, you know, this is a topic which lends itself to extremes. So it's really nice to have you acknowledging both the pros and the cons and bringing our attention to the real difficulties which can come with these chemicals and, unfortunately, which we're likely to see a lot more of as with this current resurgence of use and the legalization.
So we're going to close here, but I, as I'm going to switch to being a board member of ASI and share that we are very close to offering a closed Facebook group that will offer a more accessible forum for conversation. And hopefully at that time, I think probably all the webinars will come up and maybe we can make a dedicated space to further this conversation there. I would be happy to jump in when that happens. And also, as Craig said at the beginning, ASI is operated entirely on labors of love. So this is certainly a free webinar. And if anyone is, we want to encourage you both to join up with ASI. It is a free membership and you can leave at any time, but to consider joining up with us. And if you find this this information useful, every $5 and $10 of donation that's used, Craig and Jack and our pioneers find, you know, very dedicated 100% use of toward the vision of ASI. Craig, anything you want to say, or Rick, in closing?
Yeah, I just wanted to say truly thank you, Mariana, and thank you, Roger, so much. I think this is a topic that needs to be talked about greatly. It's just becoming more and more popular. The emergencies are happening more and more often. As soon as I'm done with this call, I'm going to talk with a psychiatrist who's dealing with a former student of mine who was in the U.S. military who did salvia and synthetic marijuana and is now in prison somewhere. And so these are real things, and they're happening to, you know, normal, grounded individuals. And there's so much danger, but then again, there's also so much promise. And so I really love what Mariana said, being for and against, and really holding this with great discernment and continuing to have this investigation, I think is so, so deeply important. So if you're not a member of the ASI, please join, you know, if you feel called. If you want to know more about us, visit the website, spiritual-integrity.org you know, sign up for the newsletter. And please, if you feel benefited by this program, offer a donation. And we look forward to seeing you next time. Thank you again, truly, Mariana and Roger, for your wisdom and everything you offered today.
Thanks so much, Craig.
Beneficial. Yeah.
Before we leave, is there anything? I always love to hear what Rick has to say. Any weigh-in of your voice before we close?
Well, it's kind of unusual that, but I don't have anything to say much at the moment, other than that I, you know, really enjoyed this conversation and, you know, everyone's contributions. And, you know, we really, I think all of us on this webinar are trying to make as much of a positive contribution to the world as we can, both through fostering our own personal evolution and then, you know, sharing the benefits of that or the outcome of that with others. So, but it's a slippery slope, you know, it's a razor's edge, this spiritual evolution thing. And it has to be approached or pursued with great care and discernment, nothing reckless or, undisciplined about it, really, if you really want to progress in a safe and assured manner. And, you know, unfortunately, by their very nature, these drugs are a little bit reckless. They're a little bit unknown. It's like Mariana said, she took something. She had no idea what was going to happen to her. She thought it was a good thing for a few months, and it turned out it wasn't. So, I don't know. To sum it up in two words, safety first.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you, Roger. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, everyone. It's been a pleasure to have you all, and truly, thanks for all your support. Everyone have a wonderful day, and peace be with you all.